SIS 105. This is fall 2010, and here is the fourth of the podcast lectures that I will deliver. And this one is called Radical Challenges to IR Theory. Not necessarily because I'm actually going to be going over lots of radical challenges in the course of this. Instead, what this particular lecture, what this particular presentation is about, is more intended to set up where some of the holes and gaps are within existing IR theories, so that then over the next few weeks, the kinds of things we read which constitute radical challenges to the existing stuff we've been talking about can be sort of slotted into their appropriate place. If I were actually to try to do a talk on all of the different kinds of radical challenges to IR theory that exist out there, well, we would be here for a very, very long time. So what I want to do here instead is I want to sketch out how some of these things come to pass. But in order to do that, I want to first summarize some of the stuff we've been talking about, and I want to draw together a few things, starting off with some definitions, because I think that's a useful way to begin. So we've been talking about world politics so far throughout the semester, and world politics I would define as pretty much everything that goes on in the world. It's a set with some very, very fuzzy boundaries. It's hard to find anything that would not be world politics in some way, since in this day and age almost everything has international and global implications, at least, you know, one or two steps removed from the particular event. So world politics is pretty much everything. And most of the time when we are studying world politics, particularly in our discussion so far, we've mostly been focusing on a subset of world politics. We've been focusing on international relations, which is to say only things that concern the relations between states, and in particular between sovereign territorial states of the more modern or contemporary variety. That means that anything that is purely domestic politics has been sort of excluded in our discussions. Even when we were talking about the mechanics of elections and democratic accountability, that was always done with an eye toward what that means for what goes on outside of the state as well. It is sometimes hard to draw the line and say where international relations stops, particularly since in this day and age, almost everything can be plausibly argued as affecting or concerning the relations between states. And certainly states are involved in almost everything these days. So it's hard to define what that space would look like. There sort of wouldn't be international relations. So the boundary is a little bit porous there too. And it's particularly complicated because it really ought not to be international relations. It ought to be interstate relations, because we're talking here about states interacting with each other. There is a long and interesting but not terribly relevant story about how we ended up with the term international rather than interstate relations. It has to do with an old set of conflations between states and nations, but not necessarily going to get into that here. Point is, we're stuck with the term. And it's a kind of imprecise term, but at least international relations is a subset of world politics, because anything that goes on in the world that doesn't end up affecting how states are relating to each other, it's a lot harder to make the case that that's part of international relations, strictly understood. All right, so that gives us world politics, that gives us international relations. Whenever anybody in the readings or in the lectures, you know, whatever, I sort of refer to IR, you should sort of hear that in capitals, because that's the name that's usually given to the scholarly study of international relations, which is a little bit different than the actual phenomenon that goes on out there. So the scholarly study of it is usually what goes under the heading of IR. And foreign policy, which we've again had some occasion to talk about a little bit, usually is defined as sort of what a state does when it acts. States acting in international relations, states acting with respect to other states, that gives you a foreign policy that a particular state has. The important thing about this is that foreign policy is performed in the name of the state, right? Foreign policy is not performed by a private actor in their own name. It is performed in some way linked to the authority and the sovereignty of the state. Therefore, one of the consequences is that only states get to have foreign policy properly or narrowly or strictly understood. Now, this is material that we talked a little bit about at the beginning of the semester, but I want to remind us of some of these definitions at the moment, because it will help to order and structure what it is that we're doing as we move forward. The question, for instance, of only states getting to have foreign policy, well, that gets challenged from time to time when other things show up. Other things come and say, we also have foreign policies. But at least as presently constituted, in order to have a foreign policy in the sort of legal, technical, or authoritative sense, you really need to be a state. If you are not, then you may have an external relations policy, and you may have perhaps a PR department with a global reach. But having a foreign policy, it's the kind of thing that sovereign states reserve to themselves. Now, in addition to these basic definitions, as we've been talking about things for the last couple weeks, we've been sort of working around different aspects of international relations. We've had occasion to talk a little bit about international political factors, the various political and military things that go on between states and affect the relations between states. You know, diplomacy, nuclear weapons, troop strength, so on and so forth. Those are the sort of things we would think of as falling into international politics, right? Political, military kinds of factors that go on between states and affect how they deal with each other. Then we've also had a little bit of occasion to mention, and we will more later on in the semester, be able to mention international economic factors, various kinds of things that affect the relations between states, trade, currency markets, how things are regulated in terms of the international economy, or what we will learn to call the international political economy, and that's stuff that we'll be starting on in a few days. But there are certainly these economic factors, there's questions of national wealth, there's questions of exchanges, questions of trade agreements, and so on and so forth. We've also had some occasion to talk about international culture, international society, social and cultural factors, norms, identities, international law, right? So we've had some occasion to be sort of working our way through some of those things as well. And these are all different aspects of what goes on out there between states and what affects the relations between states. And these three different kinds of aspects, these three headings, if you will, under which a whole bunch of individual examples could be set up pretty easily. Those aspects, right, form the actual sort of substance of what it is that we're talking about when we're actually analyzing international relations, is sort of usually some combination of these three things. And if we take these definitions and these aspects and sort of try to order them in a nice visual representation, we might get something like this. So we draw a nice yellow circle, and the yellow circle is world politics. This is sort of the biggest possible set, I suppose bigger than that, especially in light of the discussion that I had in one of the sections earlier this morning. There could be, you know, intergalactic politics, and that might be even bigger than world politics. Though conceptually I'm not sure how much that would change things, but that's a separate bit on the side. World doesn't necessarily just mean the Earth. World politics is sort of world in the sense of, like, everything, right? So world politics is sort of all these various kinds of relations that go on in the world. And international relations, as I have been arguing, is sort of a subset of world politics. It's not everything that goes on in the world, but only those things that go on between these sovereign territorial state actors, right? So that's international relations, conceptually a little smaller than world politics. And within international relations, we have these three aspects: international political, international economic, international cultural. These three things together are sometimes thought of as, or sometimes called, the international system, or different international systems, or the political system, the economic system, the cultural system. System in this sense, and there's a whole set of technical meanings associated with this, but the reason I want to use the word system is because I want to get at the fact that these things interact with one another, right? So when we talk about the international political system, we mean different sorts of political and military factors and how they relate to one another. The same with culture, the same with economics. Right, we talk about the economic system, meaning we've got lots of different parts that are somehow connected to each other. So that's the systematicity, if you will, of those three different things: the political, the economic, the cultural. Those are aspects of international relations. They're much smaller than world politics as a whole, because they're just different ways in which states relate to each other and different things that affect the relations between states. Now, in order to make some sense, I was about to say in order to order all of this chaos, but I think in order to make some sense out of all this chaos, it's a little better, doesn't repeat the word order quite as much. In order to bring some clarity to this, we have various theories of international relations. note, the theories of international relations, not necessarily theories of world politics, the theories of international relations. And the word theory is kind of important. The word theory comes from a Greek word, teoria, originally meaning to see. Theories are a way of seeing. Right? A theory of international relations, a theory of some particular domain, has certain kinds of characteristics associated with it. It's not just any perspective. It's a particular kind of perspective. In order to be a theory, it has to be somewhat abstract. Right? A theory is not about individual pieces relating to other individual pieces. It's about types and kinds. So it's not about this state and that state. It's about states. And it's not about this war and that war. It's about wars. Right? So it tends to be more abstract than the more specific concrete descriptions that you would get elsewhere. So one does not have a theory of the Second World War. One has theories about war, and then the Second World War becomes an instance or a case or an event that has to be interrogated or explained or understood using those abstract theories. Theories are also therefore general, not simply confined to one individual event or happenstance. One does not have a theory of a president. One, however, might have a theory of a presidency or the presidency as an institution, right? So general is important. And theories are also analytical, which means that theories are a means rather than an end. A theory is not an end in itself. A theory of international relations is not the point of the exercise. The theory of international relations is a tool that you use to make sense out of things that are going on in the world. So a realist theory is a theory that allows you to make sense out of things in a particular way. Right? It is a means to an end. It is analytical in the sense that you can almost think of a theory as kind of a, well, some people like to say sort of a pair of glasses you put on, but I tend to like an image more where a theory is like a transparent grid or something that you lay down on top of a phenomenon. So you got something puzzling going on out there in the world, you know, North Korea behaving the way North Korea usually does. And you want to try to figure out what's going on with North Korea. So you take a theory and you sort of lay it down on top of that. And you say, does this help me understand what's going on here? Does this make sense out of these things that were kind of puzzling before? So that's what I mean by analytical. The theory is used to help you figure out what's going on in some particular situation. Now, well, the other thing that a theory does, which is going to be tremendously important for us as we move on through the course here, is that theory sets the parameters for an argument. So having a theory about international conflict is going to help set the parameters for what happens in particular international conflicts, what we think are good solutions to international conflict, and so on and so forth. For most of this course, we're focusing on this question of parameter setting. We're not focusing so much on the question of social scientific explanation, because in order to use theories to do social scientific explanation, well, you have to have a methodology course for that. And there are such courses. There are courses like that at the undergraduate level. If you're in the School of International Service, one is required of you. In fact, it's called SIS 206. Other departments and other disciplines have their own version of this. A class that would really tell you how facts are produced within the constraints of that particular academic discipline or field. But this is not a research class so much as it is a class about arguments and perspectives, so we're going to be less concerned with how we use theories to generate knowledge and more concerned with how theories define various kinds of approaches and perspectives that we have, and therefore they are implicated in the different arguments that we will make in the specific issue areas and cases and topics that we're going to be looking at for the rest of the semester. That's sort of what theory is for in terms of this class. Now, the way that this works out is that a particular theory of international relations has to combine, on the one hand, a focus on some particular set of empirics. You know, you can have theories of international economics, you can have theories of international politics, so on and so forth. So focusing on an aspect of the international system, focusing on an aspect of international relations. But it also brings to bear on that aspect, it brings to bear a certain sensibility, basic presuppositions, commitments, assumptions that are being utilized. And we've talked so far basically about three of these traditions or schools of thought when it comes to thinking about international relations. We've talked about realism as a perspective on politics in general, world politics in general, but international relations in particular, that emphasizes the struggle for power between states. It emphasizes how states look after their national security. It emphasizes the way that states and states' leaders have to prioritize and privilege thinking about questions of attack and defense before they think about other things. So this is a realist perspective on things. A realist school of thought would be looking for those things when it comes to trying to explain what's going on between any given group of states. Now, a liberal school of thought or liberal perspective, note liberal, not liberalist. It's not liberalist. The adjectival form is liberal. A liberal perspective, right? Liberal perspective would say not necessarily that power and struggle are at the heart of all of these different political things, but that cooperation and conflict are both possible because what's really important is rational bargaining, that you can always have a different rational deal that gets struck between a couple of different states. You can have mutual benefit because states are able to strike deals where everybody is better off at the end of the day than they would have been otherwise. Right, so that is where liberals come into the picture, and that's sort of the way liberals understand what's going on out there in international relations. This is related to the fact that liberals think that democracy is special in international relations precisely because it allows the best production of exactly those kinds of rational arrangements between states that help everybody do better in the end. And the third kind of school of thought that we've been talking about a little bit is constructivism. And in constructivism, of course, identity is central. It's more central than interests. It's more central than questions of security because the goals of a state, if you're a constructivist, are actually constructed. That's the constructia part of constructivism. Identities are not given. Goals are not given. How a state decides to be, how a state's people decide to be, how a state is put together affects the kinds of goals that it has. So the identity of a state, the culture of a state, these exercise an influence on the sort of actions that the state undertakes. And as we have also talked a little bit about, how a state reacts to other states can set things in motion, conflict spirals and various forms of what Wendt, for instance, would call the reciprocal typification of others. So I treat you as an enemy, causing you to treat me as an enemy, and lo and behold, we become enemies. So constructivists would say that what's really important here is identity, and how the process of negotiation of identity works between states. So it's social action between states, which is where all the action takes place if you're a constructivist. Now, if you put schools of thought and these kind of sensibilities together with these different aspects of international relations, you come up with a set of matches, if you will, between these things. So take the three aspects of international relations: politics, economics, culture. If you are a realist, then obviously you think international politics is about security and the pursuit of security, but it's not like you don't care about economics and culture. You do. If you're a realist, you care a lot about economics, because economics, if you're a realist, is all about getting stuff, getting particular kinds of resources that you need to fuel your military machines and depriving your opponents of manganese and that kind of thing, right? So economics is just another realm for strategic power competition, if you are a realist. And culture is too. Culture is a realm for dominance. Culture is a realm for imposing your view of the world on other people. Because if you are a realist, you figure that if other people share your view of the world, they may be less likely to attack you. And if they're consuming all of the popular media products that you are producing, maybe they'll have a generally positive attitude towards you. All right, so realists are perfectly fine talking about any of these three different aspects. It's just that the bottom line is always security and power struggle. If you're a liberal, the same thing is true. In politics, you look for mutual benefit, not for security. You look in the economic system not for gaining strategic resources, but for maximizing wealth. That is what you think you're supposed to be doing rationally. And in culture, you look not to dominate, but for exchange. I have an idea, you have an idea. Let's trade ideas. Let's see what can actually work out in such a way that everybody benefits. So it's that same basic logic of mutual benefit and rational bargaining runs through all three of those aspects if you are a liberal, because the essence of a liberal approach is that rational bargaining notion. The same way that security and power seeking are at the heart of a realist approach to things. Now, if you're a constructivist, a little different, because of course if you're a constructivist, what's at the heart of things is the constructing part. So when you think about politics, politics is about community, from figuring out where the boundaries of communities are, who's in, who's out, you know, because it matters. You treat insiders differently than you treat outsiders, so figuring out where the boundaries lie is really important, and a really important political task if you're a constructivist. Economics, if you're a constructivist, doesn't look just like a bunch of rational actors pursuing wealth, and it doesn't look like a group of greedy sort of resource grabs by various states. Instead, international economics looks like a realm where governance happens, where not just rational rules are worked out, but where international institutions gain some measure of authority to be able to manage the international economic system. And of course, if you're talking about international culture and you are a constructivist, you would say this is the realm where we can find norms, rules, international law. This is where we find identity being negotiated, right, through these sorts of cultural interchanges. So that is what would happen if you were a constructivist. Any one of these three perspectives can talk about any of these three aspects of international relations by applying the same basic sensibility to that particular aspect. And that is then what you end up with the sort of meshing of schools and aspects. Now, there's another way to think about this. Another way to think about this is kind of important, because realism and liberalism as sensibilities, right? Realism and liberalism are kind of the two basic sensibilities about world politics. The two basic sensibilities about politics in general, social life in general, right? Realists think it's about power and struggle. Liberals, who think it's about rational bargaining and the proper design of institutions so everybody benefits. Right? Realists would be more inclined to say, no, it's not ever the case that everybody's going to benefit. Somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. We better make sure we're on the winning side rather than on the losing side. Right, so this is that. In some ways, this comes out as that relative gains versus absolute gains debate, but that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. What this is really about, for the distinction between realists and liberals, this is really about the question of whether politics is separable from power, whether you can rationally design your way out of power struggles, or whether power struggles are paramount. Right, that's kind of the ultimate difference between a realist and a liberal. Think about Machiavelli, who's not an IR realist, but certainly a political realist in a lot of ways. And Machiavelli pretty clearly says, right, politics is always about jockeying for position. Politics is always about struggle for domination. And if you have that kind of a perspective, then the idea that you could rationally design institutions that would get you out of that would be just kind of silly. On the other hand, if you really thought that rational design of institutions would get you out of these things, then the notion that there will always be struggle and power strikes you as somewhat archaic and perhaps even barbaric. Right, so that's the big distinction between realist and liberal sensibilities, not necessarily between theories, which are more specific, but about the general sensibility that drives realist and liberal thought. Now, if you took realist and liberal thought and you combined it with, not constructivism, but if you combined it with what you might call naturalism, which is to say, and I haven't talked about naturalism so far, and I don't want to introduce naturalism as if it was some sort of theory, because it's not, but it's a particular sensibility that, like, the world is given to you, and observers can look out there and there's a world that they can just sort of come to a particular understanding of, right? So for both realists and liberals, or traditional realists and liberals, the world is a particular way, and because the world is that way, certain consequences follow. So if you are a realist, and you think that the world is a particular way, then the way the international realm is that it is self-help under anarchy. States, sovereignty, lack of global governance. That is given if you are a realist. That is as if it were a natural fact. That is just the way things are. And so you take that as your parameter, and then you calculate what you're going to do within that as a particular parameter. That's sort of the absolute floor. If you're a liberal, and you also think the world is sort of given and has a particular character all on its own, then you say, okay, you've got individuals floating around without a common enforcer, and therefore we need to have rational institutions bargaining so we can come up with ways of dealing with this rather messy situation where states have individual authority over their own stuff. And so we want to figure out ways of being mutually beneficial, so we actually have to negotiate and create some rational institutions that are going to help us deal with this. Again, both of these assume that the world is a particular way, and the actions that states undertake should be responses to that way that the world is. If you'd introduce constructivism into this particular mix, then you get something a little different. If you introduce constructivism, you get the idea that the world isn't just out there, but that the social world is produced by social action and can be reproduced by different kinds of social action, which means it can be constructed and reconstructed. So if you have kind of a liberal sensibility that the rational design of institutions can get you away from power struggles, but you also think that the world, in a sense, can be remade by social actions, then you would say, or you might say, that states could be not just self-regarding, but they could be other-regarding. They could come to identify positively with one another. And if they did that, that would transform a whole lot of things. And there's no reason they can't, because, after all, the social world is produced by various kinds of things. So we could just produce a world through deliberate sorts of actions, where states identify with each other, they become other-regarding, and then they take each other into account. They're no longer rational egoists. They don't any longer think just about benefits to themselves, but they think about benefits to the whole group that they belong to. This is different than what happens in liberalism. In liberalism, you're always thinking about yourself. It's just that if there's a bunch of you together and everybody's benefiting, then the group as a whole could be said to benefit, but all the benefits are individual. If you are a constructivist and you are into other-regarding behavior, then it's not just that the state benefits from dealing with another state, it's that a state starts actually thinking of the whole before itself. And that's the kind of direction a lot of liberal constructivists see world politics evolving. On the other hand, if you combine this constructivist notion that the world can be made and remade with a realist sensibility about power and struggle, then you look at state activity, you look at international relations as a form of self-crafting in context, as a way states produce and reproduce themselves. So you look at how particular kinds of, say, border control mechanisms create the sense of stability and solidity within a particular state. You look at how gesturing with one's military doesn't just have effects on the military balance, but it also has effects on the identity that the state projects, and it sort of makes the state something else. So a message is sent, and enough messages being sent, enough things being communicated, can sort of reconstruct who it is that you are. You start building up a whole series of threatening military forces, and people start thinking of you as aggressive, and you sort of gain a different identity. Right? And that may actually help to remake the international environment, perhaps make it a little bit more dangerous than it was before. Right, the idea here is that if you combine a realist notion of power and struggle with a constructivist understanding that social action produces identities and things, then you get a situation where there's more subtle forms of struggle going on in international relations. So that's what happens if you take and put together these different theoretical sensibilities in particular ways. This is not exactly the same chart as the one on the previous slide, obviously, because the one on the previous slide was about specific theories of international relations. This is more about what it means to hold these positions, these particular kinds of theoretical sensibilities. All right, and both of these charts I offer as ways of trying to clarify how these different ways of thinking fit together in interesting and bizarre ways. But the sort of perspectives that we've been talking about, this is sort of how those perspectives shake out, if you will. Now, common to everything we've been talking about so far has been an assumption that we might call state centrism. IR theory, as we've been making our way through it, takes states in the state system for granted, pretty much. It sort of assumes that there have always been states, and it assumes that states are interacting in some sort of a system, and it's basically anarchic. I mean, that's kind of a built-in assumption to all these different theories of IR. The focus is on state action. What do states do, as opposed to what do other things out there in the world do, right? States tend to be foregrounded in a lot of IR work. Other actors matter only to the extent that they affect states. So really prominent social movements that don't actually affect the relations between states actually don't figure in that kind of narrowly constrained, narrowly construed IR, because it doesn't affect the relations between states, so who cares, right? One of the problems with state centrism is you can't really easily ask where the state system came from or where it's going. Are we always going to have states? Is there always going to be anarchy? Well, I don't know. If all the theories and all the perspectives assume that we start off with states and anarchy, then it's hard to actually ask the question of whether we're always going to have that, because it's already assumed. So this has other kinds of consequences as well. One of the problems is that state centrism is sort of obvious to so much of our work on international relations, so much of our thinking about international relations. It's hard for us to remember that it may not actually be the best assumption. It's hard to even ask the question, is this a reasonable assumption? Is it reasonable to assume that the world is state-centric and that international relations should be confined to the relations between states? Well, clearly states have a gigantic capacity for organized violence. Probably the largest dealers of organized death on the planet are states. They certainly can kill more people more quickly, and they can certainly kill more people over longer periods of time than terrorist groups and other things like this, which do sort of short interventions and very quick, very dramatic kinds of blowing things up. But you really want capacity for organized violence? Then you want a modern military, because they are a death-dealing machine. That is what modern militaries are set up to do, and they do it extraordinarily well. Right? State has a kind of capacity for organized violence that non-state rebel groups and things can only dream of. Right? So really, states have this huge capacity for this. States clearly have substantial economic resources. Now, granted, not all of the major economic resources are in the hands of states. And if you do a survey of the top 100 economic entities in the world, then only about half of them are states. The other half are transnational corporations of one kind or another. But states still command substantial economic resources, and they also command substantial regulatory authority when it comes to things, so they can bar corporations from getting access to certain kinds of resources and certain kinds of markets in ways that it's a lot harder for a transnational corporation to bar a state from having access to something. Happens every once in a while, but it's harder to pull off. And of course, in many forums in international politics or in world politics, the only legitimate speakers are states. Now, this gets relaxed sometimes. There are non-state actors with observer status at the UN. There are various sorts of forums and connections between social movements and the European Union, European Commission. There are ways in which different things get plugged into the process. But states are still the only legitimate speakers in lots of different kinds of forums and lots of different places in the world, on lots of different aspects of world politics. So states still have this kind of authority built in to them. But the main problem with state centrism, I think, is that it's really hard to figure out even how you would know whether the world were organized into states. I mean, how would you know that we live in a system of states? At this point, you know because you've been told. Not only I told you, but other people have told you. Other books have told you. It's one of those first sentences that you run into. The world is divided up into sovereign territorial states. Yep, sure, no problem. Except, does that really matter? Does this legal authority that inheres in sovereigns really matter? Is that really where we should be looking when it comes to thinking about politics? But it's hard to even ask that question. It's hard to figure out how you would know. How would you prove to somebody who didn't think we live in an international system that we do, in fact, live in an international system? What evidence would you cite? More to the point, what evidence would you cite that wouldn't just be a tautological restatement of the phrase, we live in an international system? It's kind of hard. It's hard to figure that out, because we make this assumption all the time. There is no simple or definitive answer to how you would know whether we live in a state system. There's an ongoing set of debates about this, in fact, in IR scholarship. What exactly is the character of world politics? What does the international system look like at the moment? All right, that's a very difficult question to answer. In particular, because the world has really changed quite a lot in the last 20, 25 years. Once upon a time, we had the Cold War. You don't remember that. And I'll tell you, I barely remember that. But most of the people who invented a lot of the IR theories around remember it and lived through it. And the Cold War, of course, you had the division of sort of the main division between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, which kind of dominated a lot of European politics and played out in various parts of the world that were not directly involved in the form of proxy wars and various ways in which countries tried to kind of jockey for position between the two superpower blocks. All of that system went away in the course of a few years, basically when the Soviet Union closed up shop. You know, one day they sort of decided not to have a Soviet Union anymore, and then poof, they just didn't. And so there's a whole lot of chaos that comes out of that. And of course the next day after they decided not to have a Soviet Union, then the Americans were sort of wondering, what the heck do we do now? Because where'd the bad guys go? Who are we supposed to be arrayed against here? It turns out that a lot of the specific theories of international relations that we had were wrapped up with Cold War era assumptions. Cold War goes away. Not so sure what we should do about those assumptions anymore. It is also the case that we now have a vastly increased volume of global trade. Right, it's almost, I think now it's actually surpassed the level that we used to have in the late 19th century, which was previously the sort of most integrated the global trading system ever was. But there's a much more increased volume of global trade now, which makes it harder and harder to just sort of blithely say, oh, we have state centrism. States are obviously the most important sort of actors. Well, when they're enmeshed in these international economic transactions all the time, it's a lot harder to say. And of course, we have the global currency markets. You know, trade may be big, but trade in a good year is, $20 trillion or something. And global currency markets in a good day are turning about $4 trillion. So a good week on the global currency markets is about the same value as a good year for global trade, which is pretty crazy. Now, of course, that's just a guess. Exactly how much that is, because there's no central authority for global currency trading, so we really don't know exactly how much of it's going on out there. But the most reliable kinds of estimates would say that it's somewhere in the $4 trillion a day range, which is a good chunk of change. All this is going on outside of state authority, and outside of state control, state capacity to monitor. And of course then, overlaid on top of all of this, or intersecting with all of this, we then have things like the war on terrorism, or the war on terror, or whatever it is they're calling it this week, in which you have a resurgence, a violent resurgence, of the old civilization versus barbarism distinction, which once upon a time was used to help legitimate colonial control over other parts of the world in terms of the civilizing mission, where the European powers felt that it was their duty to go into other parts of the world and make them like Europe, because Europe was obviously the most advanced and most important place on the planet. And if other people didn't buy that, then they had to be helped to that realization, generally with weapons pointed at them. So this was what the old civilization versus barbarism thing was used for, and that kind of language is definitely back now with this war on terror, war on terrorism, which sort of you run into the same kind of language being utilized. So you've got more economic transactions going on, you've got these sort of different and old cultural distinctions that are popping back up. In addition to this, you've also got an upsurge in ethnic politics, little respect for state borders entirely. You know, if the war on terror and the global civilization kind of language is like bigger than states and cuts through them, ethnic politics just like walks right over them. So here's our ethnic group and we happen to span three different states. Hey, but we don't care about the state because we're an ethnic group and that's what really should be important. So that's really a little bit different. Global business operations often treat borders just as obstacles to be worked around, circumvented in various ways. The fact that you can buy fast security clearance authority to get you through airport checkpoints is really interesting when it comes to this, because normal human beings can't afford those things. So who pays for that stuff? Businesses. They pay for their employees to get them through check-in lines faster. Right? So that's very interesting. States can sort of work around. States try to slow things down. Corporations work around those state borders in really fascinating ways. Right? So that really sort of makes it difficult to say that we live in a state-centric world. You have simultaneous fragmentation and all-encompassing integration. You've got European Union growing on the one hand. You've got other parts of the world where there's sort of devolution and different states are breaking up. Even within the European Union, you've got authority being consolidated at the top level, but you've also got things being decentralized. You know, there's a Welsh Parliament and a Scottish Parliament now. So some of the lawmaking authority has actually been decentralized at the same time as you're getting sort of re-centralization with the European Union. People keep trying to come up with words for this. Fragmigration is one that people like. Globalization sometimes gets utilized as a word for this. They're all just basically attempts to try to put a label to something different and some changed condition that we don't quite understand. Something is different about world politics now. We're not quite sure what it is or how to understand it. We still have those basic perspectives, sort of realist, liberal, and then the question of whether things are given or socially constructed, that those are still questions that are important, but a lot of the substantive assumptions that we used to make may not necessarily be as good anymore. That's the big hole through which these radical challenges can then come. The existing state-centric theory, to use a technical term, reifies the state. It assumes the state and makes it perhaps more solid than it actually is. Maybe states are a little bit more fragile than we think they are. State-centric theory has a hard time with certain kinds of questions. Where did the state come from? Where did we get states in the first place? Well, if you're assuming states, it's real hard to ask that question and answer it. Will we still have states in the future? Will the world be constituted by having sovereign territorial states 50 years from now? Good question. Hard to answer if you're assuming sovereign territorial states is the basis of your account of international relations. Hard to do that if you're confining yourself to international relations, which is constituted by a focus on sovereign territorial states. You kind of have to ask about other things in order to really get at this question. Right? So it changes things. State-centric theory might miss really important things that are going on out there. State-centric theory might miss small non-state actors acquiring weapons of mass destruction and utilizing them because it said, what's important are states. But maybe there are other things that are important as well, and focusing on states might actually be misdirection. So what kinds of alternatives might there be? One alternative might be to treat the state as something to be explained, not as a presupposition. That's the kind of tact that the Apello and Rossow book takes. We have to explain how forms of state authority emerge and change over time, so we don't assume it. This would also mean we should be more sensitive to different kinds of macro and micro phenomena, things that go on below the level of the state and things that go on above the level of the state. We have to be sensitive to sort of small actors, but also very large, global-spanning kinds of things, right? So don't just focus on the state, but look above and below it. Global economic inequality, for instance, something that's sort of both macro and micro. You have global economic inequality on a big scale between different regions of the world, but you also have it within particular countries and even within particular areas. Rural-urban splits. Or within cities, the rich part and the not-so-rich part. The line separating the rich from the poor doesn't necessarily always separate us from them. Sometimes it separates us from us. Right? So that these inequalities, these global inequalities, may be something that we have to take more seriously once we remove the blinders of just focusing on states as if they were solid containers. And another kind of radical challenge would be to point out that an awful lot of the discussions that we have about states and state actions are very gendered. Right, we talk an awful lot about states being bold. We talk about states being aggressive. We talk about states being tough and having fortitude and so on and so forth. Machiavelli, another great example of this, right? Machiavelli's whole language about what it is that a good political leader is supposed to do is thoroughly masculine, right? It's all a particular kind of set of male virtues that he thinks are really what's important in politics. And the ones that are not so good are the feminine ones, you know, the weakness and considering different alternatives and so on and so forth. There's a gendered component to the very way that we talk about these things. And maybe we need to take that more seriously. Maybe that's another avenue for radical challenge here in thinking about international relations. Maybe we have to take more seriously that the very constitution of international relations involves these kind of gender stereotypes. And the promise of this kind of alternative thinking is that perhaps one might be able to call the present order into question and call it to account, to evaluate it in some way. Is the world that we live in a just one? Is the world that we live in the best one we could have? Are there ways in which it could be modified? There is a kind of critical sensibility to these kinds of radical approaches, saying there are assumptions that we make and maybe we shouldn't make those assumptions. Maybe we should unmake some of those assumptions and make different ones. Maybe the world needs to be different than it presently is. Radical critiques, radical alternatives, are one way of posing those questions and pushing us toward some kind of a vision of an alternate future. And that, for a lot of theorists and a lot of scholars, is why one engages in these kinds of critiques, because the limitations of existing IR theory may not actually allow us to solve some of the most pressing questions. It doesn't mean we toss out realist and liberal sensibilities and notions of social construction. It just means we may have to think a little bit more creatively about how to apply them to a world in which you can no longer confine your attention to things that go on between sovereign territorial states. Maybe there's a broader set of concerns out there. And the challenge then becomes, how do we conceptualize this? In fact, that's the challenge we're going to be taking up throughout the course of the rest of the semester, by looking at a series of topic areas and thinking about how they work on an interstate level and then how they work on a world level outside of just the constraints of sovereign territorial states. But this is enough for right now, because what this does is gives us a little bit of a framework for how it is that these radical critiques might get started. And then we will start actually working these radical critiques in the course of the next few weeks. And I do not mean by that, I don't mean to say by that, that my implication here is that everybody should turn into a radical critic. But that if we want to take these arguments seriously, if we want to take arguments about war politics seriously, we have to take into account not just international relations theory, but also its potential limitations. And that's what the radical critics do, is show us potential limitations of IR theory. All right, enough. I'm now going to stop this, and I hope that has given you a little bit of an overview and helped to maybe wrap a few things up.